turn with me to Joshua chapter 5. And we are in the process now of having crossed the Jordan River. And we're in kind of a pause before the action takes place in the Battle of Jericho. And as you can see on the screen there, before entering the Promised Land, of course, they set up camp at Gilgal. They then actually, as we're going to see in just a minute, had two different actions. One was circumcision, the other was Passover. And in doing so, really made themselves vulnerable. And I'm going to show that in just a minute in one of those maps that Parker was talking about, how much more vulnerable they made themselves. But for those of you that were not with us last week, we've had some people asking questions, and we've gone through the book of Joshua. I thought I'd review one or two of those that we talked about last week. One of those questions were how many people were in the Exodus, and we do have that answer because in the book of Numbers it tells us there were about 600,000 men. If you do the math, it means probably about 2 million people left Egypt, crossed the Red Sea. And so the assumption always has been, well, there were 2 million people that entered into the Promised Land, and I think I made an argument against that last week, but let me explain that again, because first of all, it is quite possible that a number of people never had children when they were wandering in the wilderness. Remember, you had, of course, what happened when Moses comes down from Mount Sinai. You have various rebellions and other things. And so I think the estimates are probably too high for the number that passed the Jordan River. If for no other reason, just think about this. If you had 2 million people, that's okay. Just even assume that 20 people at a time were crossing that dry land there. That would be 100,000 lines of people crossing. That doesn't quite make some sense. But also there's another good reason. That is, as we learned last week, Joshua chapter 4 tells us that there were 40,000 men who were armed. Well, think about that. Only 40,000 out of 2 million? That's not very good. I mean, if you have an all-volunteer army, you'd do a little better than that, wouldn't you? Even if you had a 500,000 people, that's still less than 10%. So I'm thinking that we're probably dealing with a smaller group than 2 million that crossed the Jordan River. But again, that was one of them. And of course, one of the other questions was, you know, what happened when they were in the middle? And this is a picture that Gary Fraser took of, I'm just kidding, there, the Ark of the Covenant. Although they are building a new one there in Israel, and those of you that have ever gone over there actually have maybe gone to the Temple Institute where they're hoping to have that. And then one of the questions that was from last week was, well, did all of the walls in Jericho fall down? We're going to get into more of that next week. But this is a picture from Kathleen Kenyon. Remember, I showed the video last week of Kathleen Kenyon. And there is one section of Jericho where the walls did not fall down, in the northern part, a northern section right there. And you can probably, if you look at it maybe on your tablet, you can see that there is actually homes built into that wall. Now, we don't know who actually lived in that house from an archaeological point of view, but I think as we look at our Bibles, we have a pretty good idea who was living in that particular house. And so, again, we can see that archaeology is reaffirming even some of the things that we read about in the Scriptures. So what we're going to do today is focus our time and attention on two sections. And let's, if we can, turn to with us to Joshua chapter 5, verses 1 to 9. As soon as all the kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan to the west and all the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea heard that the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan for the people of Israel until they had crossed over, their hearts melted and they were no longer any spirit in them because of the people of Israel. And at that time the Lord said to Joshua, make flint knives and circumcise the sons of Israel a second time. So Joshua made flint knives and circumcised the sons of Israel at Gibeath Haraloth, and this is the reason why Joshua circumcised them. All the males of the people who came out of Egypt, all the men of war, had died in the wilderness on the way after they had come out of Egypt. Though all of the people who came out had been circumcised, yet all the people who were born on the way in the wilderness after they had come out of Egypt had not been circumcised. For the people of Israel walked 40 years in the wilderness until all the nation, the men of war who came out of Egypt, perished because they did not obey the voice of the Lord. And the Lord swore to them that he would not let them see the land until the Lord had sworn to the fathers to give to us a land flowing with milk and honey. So it was their children whom they raised up in their place that Joshua circumcised, for they were uncircumcised because they had not been circumcised on the way. When the circumcision of the whole nation was finished, they remained in their place in the camp until they were healed. And the Lord said to Joshua, "Today I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you." And so the name of the place was called Gilgal to this very day. And again, if you want to get one of those maps we were talking about here, you can see that when they crossed over, I have a red line there of the possible crossing point in the Jordan River. And it tells us, according to scriptures, that all the way back to that town of Adam was blocked. And so there was no water coming down. And then they crossed over, but then they actually made a camp in Gilgal, which put them much closer to Jericho. It's about 7 miles from their crossing point. They're within a few miles now of those walls of Jericho, and so you can see that in some respects they put themselves in a fairly vulnerable situation. And we learn now that then the kings that were in that Canaanite area were actually scared when the river dried up. So you can imagine the warriors. They're saying, okay, let's put on our shields, let's get our swords, let's go get them. Except what Joshua says at this point is, no, actually, we're not going to put on shields and we're not going to pick up our swords. We're going to get some flint knives and we're going to circumcise you. Can you imagine the reaction of that? You know, what are we doing? They might have moved their shields down. I don't know. But I mean, the bottom line is at this point, you've got to be thinking what is in the midst of their minds. They are ready to fight. They are actually in a very vulnerable position, as I pointed you out. And now the first thing he commands the army to do is circumcision. Now, why is that? Well, first of all, it was meaningful. We go all the way back and you might put a note and you're taking some notes in your handout today, Genesis 17. You can read about the initiation of circumcision and why that was important. It was certainly a sign of a covenant between God and the chosen people. It was an outward sign, if you will, of their dependence upon him. Why flint knives? Well, again, you can go to Exodus chapter 4 and see that that was what was required. So they are now making knives of flint. And then the name of this place, since most of us don't study Hebrew, it's kind of interesting. Gibeath Haraloth actually means hill of foreskins. Don't get that image in your mind too much, but nevertheless, it shows you what happens when you circumcise at least the 40,000 men that were warriors plus all of the others. You can figure out why they named it in that case. Now, there's been a real interesting kind of speculation. Why is it that when you had circumcision instituted all the way back to the book of Genesis, that while they're wandering in the wilderness, no young boy who is born is circumcised? Now, I've seen some people suggest that maybe it just fell out of practice. Maybe they were in the midst of disobedience. Maybe it just was not convenient. I think there's a better answer. And that is, I think, since they were in the midst of being judged, God prohibited them from doing that. Okay, if they were under God's judgment, I came up with at least 3 reasons why they were in God's judgment. You can come up with more, but the first one I put down here is, first of all, they rebelled against God. I think we would all agree with that. Number 2, we see that in some cases they practice idolatry. Remember the golden calf? And in number 3, they refuse to enter into the land. We read about that in Numbers 14. And as I was looking at that, I said, well, certainly that does not describe the United States of America, does it? Let's look at them again. Rebelled against God. Do we have anybody in this country that's rebelling against God right now? Even if you look into the church, you see some people in the church rebelling against God. What about idolatry? Well, okay, I don't have too many idols that I've seen in too many people's fireplace mantles, but if idolatry means putting something else in the place of God, right? I mean, this week we had this big debate about whether we're going to take Andrew Jackson off the $20 bill, right? And some people have suggested, well, let's put him on the backside and cover over where it says, "In God we trust." Seriously, I'm not making this up. Those of you listened Friday, Kelly Shackelford said he's got another lawsuit he's now fighting against Michael Dudow, who wants to take "In God We Trust" off of our money. But the point I'm making is some people have said, no, we just need to spell it differently. "In Gold We Trust." you know. And if you think about this, do we really? How many people in America really trust God anymore? Think about that. Is that idolatry? Maybe. Okay, they refuse to enter the land. Okay, well, we don't have a command to enter the land. We do have, if I remember right, a command to go out and make disciples of all nations, don't we? We're going to talk about this in just a minute. How are we doing on evangelism and discipleship? You know, you can kind of see where that kind of fits in. Do you love that segue, Ted? I mean, we're perfect segue there into what we're going to be talking about in just a minute. I think if nothing else, it's a good illustration of what we have here in terms of the fact that there was disobedience in that day and there was a consequence. Now again, we no longer have circumcision, but instead God has given us baptism, and I want to come back to that, as you'll see in your handout in the application point in just a minute. But let's keep moving, because we want to leave time for our second session here as well. And that is, now we will begin in chapter 5, verse 10. While the people of Israel were encamped at Gilgal, they kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month in the evening on the plains of Jericho. And the day after the Passover, on that very day, they ate the produce of the land, unleavened cakes and parched grain. And the manna ceased the day after they ate of the produce of the land, and there was no longer manna for the people of Israel, but they ate of the fruit of the land of Canaan that year. Then verse 13, when Joshua was by Jericho, he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, a man was standing before him with his drawn sword in his hand. And Joshua went to him and said to him, are you for us or for our adversaries? And he said, no, but I am the commander of the army of the Lord. Now I have come. And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshiped and said to him, what does my Lord say to his servant? And the commander of the Lord's army said to Joshua, take off your sandals from your feet, for the place where you are standing is holy. And Joshua did so. And so now we see that there are a couple of other aspects of this as well. First, circumcision. Now, the issue of the Passover, an alternative diet. And so immediately after the circumcision, then they have Passover. Why was that? Well, again, I give you another reference you might want to put in your notes, and that is in Exodus 12, verse 48, it explained that no uncircumcised man could eat the Passover. So before the Passover, you had to have the circumcision. And so that is the case. And here, the nation of Israel is putting God first in the land of Canaan by doing those right things. Kind of intriguing. They recognize how important it was to be right with God before they go into battle. This week, as a matter of fact, there is a major case that's going to be going before the military high court, kind of the Supreme Court of the military, and it has to do with a case that goes all the way back to the issue of the chaplains. And if you're familiar at all, as we've talked about in this class before, who initiated the chaplains in the military? Was George Washington, and he was convinced that he wanted to make sure that they had a right heart, that they would pray. Matter of fact, you could be punished even for using profanity, because they felt that they only if their hearts were right could they possibly have a chance of defeating the greatest military power of the 18th century. I see that same principle here. If we're going to go against Jericho, it isn't going to be our military armaments or our sophisticated training is going to make a difference. It is whether we're right with God. And so here we see that that's the reason they actually were able to have so many victories. In a couple of weeks, we're going to look at one time when they had a defeat, and that's because they weren't right with God. So here we see the importance first of circumcision and then the Passover. And it's interesting that the celebration of Passover Gilgal really shows a whole new era, because as we just read a minute ago, as soon as the Passover was celebrated, something that had happened for 40 years stopped. And what was that? For 6 days every week for 40 years, the manna fell from heaven. You know, it was perfect welfare, if you will. You know, you didn't have to go out and work, just had to collect it. It was right there for you. And all of a sudden it says, now that's done. And so this now becomes the first time that the families were actually gathering together for the meals that they had prepared, from things like the bread and the meat and the fruit, and most importantly, the land flowing with milk and honey that they gathered together. And so we can see that this was the end of one era and the beginning of another, as illustrated by the fact that the manna stopped and now the responsibility was theirs. Still in their minds, and maybe even the minds of Joshua, he's still thinking, this is an impenetrable fortress. I'll show you the pictures of it once again. We looked at those last week. I mean, this was overwhelming. Many people think of this as a city. There's a lot of evidence that suggests it was really merely more like a fort. It was an attempt to protect the area. And so when they talk about those who were killed, mostly it was the soldiers. There weren't a lot of women there, although we do know that Rahab was there and a few others for reasons we've already figured out. But nevertheless, it was pretty much a fortress, and it was one that nobody could come against. And so he's probably even, as he's walking around near Jericho and looking at those walls, thinking about this, and then, of course, we see that as he's walking this land and trying to think about this, he then draws his sword because he sees another man with a sword, and he says, are you for us or for our adversaries? And I love the answer. He says, no, I'm the commander of the army of the Lord. And at this point, when he realizes who it is, he falls on his face. Now, this encounter is open to some debate. If you want to start a conversation or even a debate at a seminary, you can say, who was this individual? Was it an angel? Some people suggest it was what's called a Christophany. That is, that it was a pre-incarnate Christ. We've talked about this in the class, haven't we? Remember when we went through the book of Hebrews, we talked about Melchizedek? That could have been a pre-incarnate Christ. Some people think this might have been as well. David Limbaugh has a new book out, which we mentioned a while back, that deals with other appearances of Christ in the Old Testament. David Limbaugh's brother does radio. I forget what his name is. But anyway, you know, that's a fascinating book right now about the Christophany. And if you go back into history, if you ever read John Bunyan, I mean, he spends a fair amount of time talking about how Christ appears in almost every book of the Bible. We sort of lost that. And some of the people now in the 21st century say, maybe we should go back to the 15th and 16th century and interpret Scripture the way maybe it was intended to be interpreted. But nevertheless, we see that he says, well, does my Lord say to my servant? And so in this particular case now, he recognizes he's in the presence of something that is divine. And the answer is kind of unexpected. I think he's thinking, well, what am I supposed to do? How are we supposed to fight? And instead, the first answer is what? Take off your sandals, because what? This is holy ground. Does this remind you of anything else? Well, put down there Exodus 3, right? You know, just as God has commissioned Moses before the burning bush and tells him to take off his sandals in this holy ground, now God is commissioning, I believe, through the pre-incarnate Christ or an angel, whatever you want to believe, and now commissioning him to take off his sandals because this is holy ground. And so again, this is an opportunity to once again recognize that even though you're fighting down here on earth, there's a battle taking place in the heavenlies as well. And there's a spiritual battle taking place. And so that is certainly the case. And so, you know, we even mentioned last week that this did not remain a holy place. At this particular time, it was a holy place, and Gilgal is a holy place. And later on, Saul, when he wants to actually be anointed king, he goes to Gilgal because he's thinking, well, that's still a holy place. But certainly by the time we get to the so-called minor prophets, we recognize it's no longer a holy place there. Amos and Hosea describe it as a place of, for example, where there's apostasy and where there's false oaths. We also see that Amos talks about the fact there's a place where there are empty sacrifices being offered by insincere worshipers. And so we can kind of see that even though it was a holy place at that time, later on you can see the natural trajectory. It's so sad that oftentimes great spiritual churches sometimes later end up in apostasy. Great Bible colleges and seminaries end up in apostasy. That's the natural drift if we don't work to try to maintain it. And here we see that eventually God abandons it, even though the people tried to seek him there, which we read about in the book of Amos. Just before we go to our second point, let's, if we can, look at some application points. And I mentioned just a few here that I thought would be of help to you. And the first one has to do with this issue of circumcision. And we recognize today that we no longer practice circumcision as a religious activity. Sometimes people do it for medical reasons. But if nothing else, we see that Israel, as we pointed out, departed from the practice. There was a time in which they were no longer obedient to God, and no longer did God allow his blessing to be placed upon them. And so this is a question we can ask for our nation. It's even a question we can ask for our own church. Certainly it's a question we ask for our own individual lives. Is it possible that sometime we would be so disobedient that God's hand of blessing would just be removed from us? We see what that was the case. And so circumcision was both an outward sign as well as an inward commitment. And if you think about it, it's a pretty significant commitment. The commitment to be baptized today, wasn't that great to see him baptized his own daughter? I mean, he just broke up. That was wonderful. But, you know, the commitment to baptism is a bit of a commitment. The commitment, guys, to circumcision, that's a big commitment, right? You know, if nothing else. And I think it's the outward sign, but it's the inward commitment. And so here, I think what we have here is in baptism the same idea. There's nothing that saves you in terms of baptism, but it's the outward sign that gives you the inward commitment. Now, yesterday, I was getting theological questions at the Skeet Field, and even Friday night at the Gaither concert, I was getting theological questions, and one of those has to do with the fact that right now, this is the Jewish celebration of what? Passover. And one of our people in our class here was actually witnessing to someone who is Jewish and saying, well, what about this issue of baptism, and have Jews ever baptized? And so I gave my short answer at the Gaither concert, a little bit longer one at the Skeet Field, and now I'm going to give you the full answer right now. And that is, yes, it turns out that you can go back in history and find that there were some Jews that were being baptized even before John the Baptist, but they baptized themselves. They would go into the mikveh. That's where you would wash yourself and clean themselves out, and then we come up for, or sometimes they would be baptized in the river, but they would baptize themselves. As far as we can tell from history, the first person that baptized someone else was what? John the Baptist. And of course, this is now the outward celebration, if you will, of an inward commitment. And so once again, we see how important baptism is. Baptism does not save, but I believe that it's an important ordinance for believers. So that's the first issue. The second one is, what about this army of the Lord? And I think it brings us back to this. Hopefully you can see that. Yeah, you can see that pretty good. On the walls of Jericho, and just to recognize why Joshua is walking by the walls of Jericho, because I think he's thinking to himself, how do we do this? Look at down here. See, I think we can pretty much show this gray. Yeah, you can't see the green very well. But first of all, if you see in the lower right-hand side, those are supposed to be men, and you first of all have a retaining wall that's 12 to 15 feet high. We know how high it is simply because we have done archaeological investigations of that. So just even to get to the first wall, there's a retaining wall that is sort of at an angle. So just imagine that even if you could get up there, and now there is some evidence that there were probably archers up there shooting down even as you were trying to do that. But then you now have to go up that 26 feet high wall, and then there's this open area where then anybody else shooting down at you, throwing spears, throwing hot liquids on you and all that, and then going up another 26 foot wall to finally get in. You can see how this seemed to be impenetrable. And so it now brings us to this idea of the army of the Lord. You know, many believe that this army of the Lord, it could be, for example, that there was an angelic army that would provide a victory from the skies while Joshua's troop carried out the work on earth. And so you see that pattern. You know, we have God's responsibility and our responsibility. And so they were to do, as we'll see next time, some very specific things, and then the walls come down and they finish that off. And so this is God's heavenly army really fighting on behalf of Israel. And the commander of the Lord's army is saying, you know, you're not here by yourself. You're not going to have to fight this battle for yourself. We're going to go before you and help you deal with this incredible set of walls that seem impenetrable to you. And really that, I think, is the only explanation for how he was able to do that. If you want to go to Jericho to this day, you can actually go and look. This is the tell of Jericho, and we can actually see how the walls fell down, and we can see the ramparts over here on the left. And again, you can look at this later when you go on to the material that Parker has posted on our website, and you can see that this is what is left of Jericho. Isn't that amazing? Now think about that. If you were at that time and you were to travel all through the Canaanite area, they could tell you the names of the kings. They could tell you the number of people that fought in that battle. They could tell you how many people were in Jericho. And you'd say, well, what about Joshua? Who's he? Oh, those people that, you know, supposedly traveled all through the wilderness, well, they're no great concern to us. And yet today, who are the names we know from Jericho? Joshua and Rahab. Does anybody know the name of any one of those kings, any one of those commanders? And I think it illustrates, if nothing else, one of the great spiritual lessons. If you are looking for God to tear down some walls in your life, recognize that what was seemingly impenetrable back in their day is now nothing more than an archaeological relic that a few people occasionally travel to look at and say, well, that's what is left of the mighty fortress of Jericho. Good way to end.